Welcome, everyone, today. It's either a good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. My name is Jean Valance, and I work with the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'm here to help moderate a Clue-In Internet seminar on alternative dispute resolution, or ADR, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice. With each Clue-In seminar, if you have not picked up on it yet, or this is your very first one, Clue-In seminars will function very similar to a conference call style event. You want to be sure to have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of you today. If you haven't done so already, I'll direct you back to the seminar homepage, which you would have seen when you registered for today's event. On that seminar homepage, you could find a complete description, logistics information for today's session, contact information for myself and our presenters, as well as links to either go to the seminar, which appear on the left side of the screen, as well as buttons along the bottom to actually download a copy of the presentation material as either PowerPoint or PDF. So you can view it in one of three formats. You just want to be sure to have it pulled up in front of you, and everyone should be starting on the title slide or slide number one. I'm going to ask everyone to move along and turn the page to slide number two, which is our housekeeping slide. And if you haven't guessed it yet, each individual participant will be expected to manually advance through the materials at verbal cues from our presenters. So for those of you just joining us, we're on slide number two. Everyone who's on the phone lines, we would ask that you place your phone on mute. You can simply hit *6 to mute your line, and then #6 if you need to unmute it when we get to the point with Q&A. We would ask that you don't put the call on hold. There can be background music or commercials that can be very disruptive. If you need to hang up, you're welcome to disconnect and then simply rejoin the call whenever you need to. There won't be any interruptions. So simply keep yourself on mute by using *6, and you'll be able to unmute hitting #6 to ask a question or make a comment, and I'll provide reminders of that throughout today's session. Again, we will take breaks for Q&A with our presenters. You just want to be sure, though, if you're listening to us electronically, in other words, you're streaming audio online, you don't have to worry about muting your line because you're simply listening to us through your computer. However, if you'd like to submit a question or comment to our presenters, you'll need to use our electronic question form. Those of you who are looking at the slides online in the web browser window will see a series of numbered links that appear on the left-hand side of the screen. And they're numbered slides 1 through the end of the slide collection. You can use those numbered links to advance through the materials, and again, I'm on slide number 2. You'll also notice at the very top of each slide there are a series of orange icons which will help you move through the materials. The single arrow pointing to the right will advance you one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. The question mark button on that collection of orange icons, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, will actually open up the electronic question form that I mentioned earlier. And for those of you streaming audio, you'll need to submit your questions or comments that way. So you're welcome to submit electronic questions or comments at any point in time. You don't have to wait to the designated Q&A time. In fact, we'd encourage you to type them up as soon as they occur to you. So when we do take breaks for questions with our presenters, we'll be able to go through that queue and read them off out loud on your behalf so that presenters can answer them in a timely fashion. All right, we've kind of covered how we're going to move through all those materials. Again, if you're just joining us on the phone lines, we're on slide number 2, our housekeeping slide. I would also remind everybody that today's session is being recorded, and you will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that recording is available for free replay and download. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks. If you're interested in browsing the current archives that we have available for free on Clue-In, we have about 430 different sessions that we've recorded in the past 10 years or so. You're welcome to visit the URL on the bottom of slide 2 to take a look at it. Now, those are the end of the formal reminders that I have, so I'm going to actually ask everybody to move along to slide number 3, which is the start of the technical presentation for today. Again, today you're here for an internet seminar on alternative dispute resolution that's been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice. This webinar will describe the ADR process, a procedure that's used to resolve issues in controversy, including those of facilitation, mediation, and arbitration to resolve environmental justice or EJ concerns. The course will show how the ADR can result in improved communication, more positive relations, and a greater mutual respect and support. We have 3 presenters who will be joining us from EPA's Office of Conflict Prevention and the EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. We have Anna Abbey, Deborah Dalton, and Aileen Carlos from EPA's, again, Office of Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to our presenters today on slide number 3.
Thank you very much, Jean, and we'd like to also thank the Office of Environmental Justice for inviting us to participate and share with you today. Moving on to slide number 4, before we get into introductions, we'll go over what we're going to look at today. We'll do some brief introductions, both on the individuals here in the room being where we're presenting from, and as well as the office that we're from. We're going to look at what ADR is, including definitions, as well as different types of cases, what the process looks like, and some real-world examples in the context of environmental justice. We're also going to look at some specific issues that arise with the issues of environmental justice and how ADR is applied in that context. And then we'll have a conclusion. Moving on to slide 5 and then quickly on to 6. My name is Anna Abbey. I am in the right in the lovely hat with a desert background. I work for the Conflict Prevention Resolution Center. My formal title is Conflict Resolution Specialist. And I work primarily on Superfund-related cases, but also have a specialization in environmental justice and tribal concerns.
I'm Deb Dalton. I have been working on EPA issues for about 33, 34 years in the pesticides, toxics, enforcement, and Superfund arenas, and have been working on alternative dispute resolution and public participation for probably about 25 of those years. And you'll see me on the upper left. Anna managed to capture a very photophobic person here walking along the edge of a Superfund site in New England.
And I'm Aileen Carlos. I'm the one in the lower sort of middle area. I am a student at the University of Oregon School of Law. I am completing a JD and a master's at the same time. My master's will be in conflict resolution, and I'm the intern for the CPRC this summer.
Yay. Thank you, my fellow presenters, and we're happy to be here with you and sharing with you today. Now a little bit more about what the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center is. Slide 7. Essentially, we have this lovely little office here in headquarters that serves the entire country and all of the regions therein on working with alternative dispute resolution and some of the other terms that we'll define later on for environmental disputes, environmental conflicts. We help identify and contract with facilitators and mediators, and we'll go over what exactly that means later on. We help find funding and or assist with funding from our own office to make sure that those mediators and facilitators can work with the projects. We assess obstacles to agreement and help design effective ways to handle an angry public or work with a community, rather. And all of this is an internal focus to assisting EPA-related activities. We also provide training and coaching on negotiation, facilitation, and community engagement. And this kind of is part of that endeavor right now, is helping to assist in the education of everyone here on the line about what ADR is and how it's used. Slide number 8. So for an environmental context, environmental justice context, I should say, we just wanted to highlight for you that environmental justice issues can be enormously complex, involve many factors, require human, technical, legal, and financial resources, and need a multitude of individuals working together for a common goal. In addition to that, there are elements of mistrust and histories of injustice that could potentially be generations long. These challenges often seem insurmountable, and the conflict may seem inevitable given the multitude of interests that are at play and the history. And ADR is a tool that can be really helpful in working through some of these complex issues and difficulties and really finding a solution that will lead to lasting change. Slide 9.
All right, so we're going to generally go over what is ADR. ADR tends to have a lot of acronyms, as most, I think, governmental agencies have a lot of acronyms. So I want to briefly go over some of what we'll be talking about generally and just see if y'all have any questions after that. So next slide, I think slide 10 or slide 11. What is alternative dispute resolution? The general definition encompasses a lot of processes, and each may look and feel a little bit different for both the neutral and the participants. It's defined as any procedure that is used to resolve issues and controversy, including but not limited to conciliation, facilitation, mediation, fact-finding, mini trials, arbitration, and the use of ombuds or any combination thereof. So it is a lot of different processes. You may have come across a couple of these in your professional life or in your personal life. And so we'll just go over a few. Next slide. In other words, ADR is really any sort of neutral assisted negotiation process that's intended to resolve issues and controversy and is outside of the court system. A couple examples of ways in which you may have come across ADR in your home, in your personal life is oftentimes divorces will go through family mediation. It's being more commonly used in divorce practices because you have an ongoing relationship between the parents, especially if there's kids involved. And so the parents often don't want to go through a really acrimonious court litigation, divorce proceeding. They want to be able to maintain some sort of relationship. And so oftentimes families going through that sort of situation will enlist the help of a mediator in order to make everything work a little bit better. Another way you may have come across it is peer mediation in schools. So there's a lot of peer-to-peer mediation. Anytime there's a conflict between children in high school or in elementary school, it helps provide ownership of the issues and empowers the kids to be able to resolve their issues within themselves without involving the administration. The last one is probably the more famous example. NBA and NFL negotiations. More recently this year, the NBA went through a lot of protracted negotiations between the coaches and the owners and the players that impacted this season. They ended up using neutrals, facilitators, and mediators in order to try to resolve those contract disputes because they were unable to resolve it between themselves. And so oftentimes, whenever negotiations reach that stage at which they're stymied, they look for outside neutral facilitators to help ease the process and to help bring in a new, fresh insight. So that's where ADR comes involved in business transactions. Next slide. So the ADR attributes are that it's voluntary. All of the participants who come into ADR will come in because they want to. It's designed with the input of the parties. The parties really decide which one of those processes, conciliation, facilitation, mediation, which one will work the best for them. It's very flexible, the process. It's responsive to the participants. It's informal. It's completely confidential. We really embrace the fact that you should be able to talk about anything you want in an ADR process. It's going to be completely confidential. And because of all these things above, the potential for a broader scope of outcomes is extremely large. And next slide. Two acronyms we want to discuss in particular are CPS and ECR. Collaborative problem solving is CPS. It's any process in which individuals can come together to solve their joint problems in an open manner. It's kind of a catch-all for many, many of our ADR processes. More specifically, environmental conflict resolution, or ECR, is the umbrella term for any ADR or CPS process that is specifically geared towards an environmental issue or an environmental problem. Next slide. I mentioned the word neutral earlier, and this is going to come up quite a lot. What is a third-party neutral? It's a person who's impartial, without a stake in the outcome, who will help the parties resolve their dispute through mediation, facilitation, or another ADR process. Typically, as you can probably infer from that, the person is not going to be directly involved with any sort of dispute or issue that's going on. It is going to be somebody who can help mediate the issue between the two participants. Next slide. At this point, I'd like to take a pause and ask if anyone has any questions about ADR generally, about any of the processes I mentioned, or about anything about this webinar, I suppose, right now.
Jean, would you like us to read the questions on the slide, or?
I'm more than happy to read those out if you guys want to. So the first question we actually have came in, it was from me, and the question was asking about who can access your services. Is it just meant for EPA staff, or can communities take advantage of your services?
Our services from the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center are just for EPA staff. We're all EPA employees. We're funded through EPA as an integral part of EPA. That said, if a community is working on an environmental issue in which the EPA is involved, they can talk to those EPA staff members to see if mediation or facilitation is something that they're willing to engage in. That said, ADR as a broader process, environmental conflict resolution as a broader process, can be used by anybody in a variety of contexts, like Aileen mentioned. And there are a multitude of community mediation resources out there in the world, as well as other for-profit or nonprofit organizations that deal with environmental conflict resolution.
Okay, great. Just for those who are asking the slide number, we're currently on slide number 15, which is our break for questions. We do have another question that came in from Arlington, Virginia, and they asked, what do you do if you have three or four parties that want to use ADR, but one party that does not? Do you go forward with just the ones that want to use it?
Okay. One of the things that we'll talk about in a few minutes is doing a situation assessment with the parties, where you try to figure out what is motivating each of the parties and what may be barriers to participation and what might be incentives to participation. And so generally the neutral will try to talk to all the parties and figure out what how they're involved and what are their barriers and incentives to participating. Sometimes you can go ahead with an ADR process that doesn't involve a party who doesn't want to be involved. For instance, we've done some policy dialogues in the past where Greenpeace, as an international organization, did not want to come to the table as an environmental group. They didn't oppose everybody else coming to the table, but they wanted to reserve their ability to demonstrate their advocacy through demonstrations and letter-writing campaigns and direct contact with legislative bodies. So it just depends on why it is they don't want to participate and whether that leaves a hole in the balanced representation idea.
Okay, great. And we'll just check quickly to see if anybody on the phone lines has a question. If you're on the phone and have muted your line using our command, the unmute command is #6. So feel free to hit #6 and go ahead and let us know either yourself or your organization to ask your question. Okay, I don't hear any questions coming in. So if you guys would like, we can go ahead and continue on from slide number 15 on to slide number 16.
Okay, here we are at 16, which you can skip and go right on to 17. So this is Deb, and as you've heard from Aileen, that ADR is basically the use of a neutral third party to manage discussions and negotiations. So the first step is to really figure out whether or not ADR is a useful process to go through for the discussion or the issues or the negotiation. And we call this convening. Convening is basically when the neutral third party helps the parties, all of them, determine whether or not to proceed with in-person negotiations and how to proceed, whether a neutral is necessary or whether they can manage the negotiations on their own. This convening might include what we call a situation assessment, which I'll explain in a minute. It may include selecting a neutral who is jointly acceptable to all the parties, and it may include process design. Next slide on to slide number 18. You'll see here just a quick diagram, which you'll see a couple times during this presentation, kind of showing you where we are in the process, the linear process of an ADR process. So here we are, situation, conflict assessment. Can move now on to slide number 19. So situation assessment is a mindful exploration by a neutral third party of whether or not an ADR process is useful. It helps to prepare the path for parties coming together. It helps to design a process that parties can interact with to make sure that they're all represented and they're going in the right direction. May include, by the end of the situation assessment, a determination that it's the situation isn't ripe, or the parties can't appear in the same room, or there's really no agreement on what the goal of a process could be. The next slide, number 20, the key elements of a situation assessment. The neutral third party seeks to understand what the issues are and who the people are who need to be involved in resolving those issues or moving forward with some solution to the issues. It's kind of like the neutral approaching the situation as a jigsaw puzzle, but without the box and the picture on the front. So you've got all the pieces scattered all over, and you have to gather them up and see if there are ways to group them and figure out what kind of picture you're looking at. Are you looking at a picture of kittens, or are you looking at a picture of Grand Teton National Park here? So the neutral spend some time with each of the parties that they can find, finding out the background, the history, the context of the issues, and the context of the relationships between the people or the organizations. The neutral will ask for a description from each of the parties of what they think the issues are. Again, it's a case maybe even of combining two or three puzzles and seeing if you can make one puzzle out of two or three puzzles. The neutral will try to find out if people are on board with similar goals or end products that they want to achieve at the end of this. There'll be an analysis of opportunities for coming together and solving problems, also an analysis of some of the challenges that need to be overcome before you start or while you're talking. At the end of the situation assessment, the neutral may present either a formal or just a very informal conversation presentation of what they've found and what the recommendations are for moving forward, the process design, any recommendations for preparatory activities, any recommendations on how people or organizations should participate, and how to deal with participants that may not want to participate or may want to watch and comment in some other way. This sharing of the design with all the parties allows all of the parties to the issue to contribute to a discussion and analysis on whether or not they can go forward, to identify some points of disagreement about how to proceed, and to build some agreement. It's kind of sometimes the first agreement that parties have had, which is, okay, we agree that we could go into a process. We agree that this is a good neutral to guide us. We agree that there's a process that we can enter into and jointly perform. So it's kind of your first little landmark, particularly in those situations where there's been a lot of conflict or adversarial behavior going on. Our next slide, slide 21. The factors that mediators may take into consideration when recommending ADR or not include whether or not there are a limited number of issues with a number of possible resolution scenarios. If you just have a situation in which the answer is A or B or option one or option two, you're probably more in a situation where people are going to be perhaps more comfortable voting than trying to reach any kind of joint decision because they have limited options. Are there enough identifiable participants who have the resources and the knowledge and the interest and energy to participate? Or are there too many? The general citizens of the United States might be way too many people to involve in a collaborative process, but if you can identify representatives of various kinds of interest clumps, you might be able to bring enough people together to move forward with some actual negotiations. Does everybody have access to sufficient information, or do you need to design a process in which the goal of the process is to generate or discover the information that's necessary to then take the next step to decide options? What are the deadlines? If there's no deadline, generally people don't make decisions. Just think about the last time, you know, you had to make a decision about something. It's a lot easier to make a decision about which of 25 car models you might choose if your car just broke and you have to use it to get somewhere. But if you're like me and your car's working just fine and you might have another 8 years, deciding what kind of car is just not happening anytime soon. Are there any common shared positions? Usually it's nice to have people at least agree that the environment is important, that our children need to be protected. These kinds of base kinds of agreements are useful. Nobody disagrees with them. It's not always something you can build agreement on. But you can keep reminding people of, yes, we have some goals in common, even if we have some options that might not be jointly approvable. Do you need to have an ongoing relationship? Most of the time, if you're going to deal with particularly environmental problems, the solutions to environmental problems typically take months or years or decades to solve. And so the parties have ongoing relationships, and ADR can be used to help build those relationships or to repair some of those relationships. Is there litigation? There's lots of litigation out there in the world. We're trying to derail our friend Aileen here from becoming a litigation lawyer. Some of you out there might be in law school and headed that direction. But litigation does impact the use of ADR. Sometimes if you're in litigation, there can be a stay to see if settlement's possible from the judge. There might be delays that you can jointly agree to for discovery deadlines or pleadings deadlines. Sometimes you may have to operate an ADR process in parallel with litigation. And in many of those cases, to the extent possible, it's useful to have a litigation team and an ADR team that so that everybody's not trying to do everything and accomplish the goals for that. So the situation assessment is presented, the parties consider it, and then take the next steps.
Slide 22 is the next step, looking at process design. So at this point, Deb's gone through all of the different issues that would come up in a situation assessment. You would know what's going on. You would have kind of an understanding of the goals that you want to achieve, who the relevant players are, and have some ideas for what that process might look like going forward. And all of this depends on the extent to which the situation assessment is done. If it's very informal, you may not have all of the answers. If it's very structured and a long-running situation assessment, you may have already designed the process essentially through doing that. Slide 23. So, there's a lot going on here. As Aileen mentioned when she was discussing the definition of ADR, there are a lot of different types of processes that fall under that definition. All of the light blue ones that you see there are listed are types of ADR. You have decisional assistance, which is essentially binding arbitration, where you might bring in a neutral arbiter to make a legally binding decision. You have advisory assistance, which is more like a non-binding arbitration. That means you bring somebody in and they tell you what they think should happen, and you can decide whether or not you want to go through with that without any kind of legal ramifications. You can have substantive assistance. That's more like the mini trials or joint fact-finding, where essentially you work together to find the scientific or whatever information that you need to find to be able to move forward. Process assistance is essentially where a lot of the environmental conflict resolution falls, and that's looking at mediation and facilitation. And then there's the relationship assistance, which is more like conciliation, which is using a third party to kind of work with individual parties to kind of get to them to a point where they can stand one another. But looking at process assistance, you'll notice that it's to the left of the spectrum. It involves participants more in the process. It involves them more in the design as well as in the process itself as representations. And it also involves them in the ultimate decision. They have more say in what happens. And all of these things are really great in terms of moving people towards a place where they're empowered to take action and meet their mutual interests. Now, in addition to deciding where on this spectrum your ADR process may fall, you also have a lot of different decisions to make beyond that. So say we choose that it's a process assistance, we need mediation or facilitation, and I'll go into that a little bit more in a minute. You also have to determine where you're going to meet, how often are you going to meet, how long are those meetings going to last, what are you going to do at those meetings. For example, are you going to do small work group kind of things, or are you going to do presentations? Do you need to have question and answer sessions, or an open house, or a poster session, or a World Cafe, or, oh my gosh, what are you doing, right? There's a lot of different tools that mediators, facilitators have that they can bring to bear. That also involves, you know, room design. If you're doing small group work, you don't want people sitting in an auditorium. They won't be able to move around. They won't be able to talk to one another. So all of these things go into determining what this process looks like, how you design the structure and the setup of what's going to happen. And all of it is case dependent. And all of it is based on essentially who are the individuals at play, what are important to them, and what are the goals, what are you trying to achieve in this process. For example, you know, if some of the stakeholders are essentially, you know, working folks whose job is not related directly to environmental conflict resolution type stuff or the dispute in question, they may not be able to get out of work during the day to come to a meeting. So you have to think about that in your design process and make sure that it's inclusive of all participants and maybe design something on the weekend or in the evenings. All of that kind of swirls around, which is why we really promote the use of a situation assessment to understand all of those pieces before kind of committing to and designing a process so that the process can be the most effective, most tailor-made process for the situation. So that's really what leads to amazing success in these processes. Moving on to slide 24. So a little bit more about mediation facilitation. Mediation is a process in which a neutral third party, the mediator, assists disputants in reaching a mutually satisfying settlement of their differences. It's voluntary, informal, confidential, all those great things that Aileen mentioned that ADR generally is. Any agreement that is reached must satisfy all of the disputants. Essentially, if they do not agree to it, then the mediation it breaks down and they find other ways of achieving their goals. Facilitation on slide 25 is a process used to help the group or group of people or parties have constructive discussions about complex or potentially controversial issues. A facilitator helps by getting the parties to set ground rules for these discussions, promoting effective communication, eliciting creative options, generally keeping the group on track so they don't get waylaid in storytelling or big personalities don't take over the group or bullies don't emerge that really manipulate the situation. They're the referee that guides the process through so that people can communicate fully. Now, both of these things kind of have a large overlap on the Venn diagram. Mediators and facilitators might be the same person. They might be different people. They might, you know, one individual might call themselves a facilitator, but really they're doing mediation. In the field, there's not a big consensus on what the differentiation is between those two things, but they are terms that get used pretty broadly. There are cases that are agreement-seeking that one might consider a mediation, but for reasons of sensitivities, I guess, for lack of a better word, the parties may not feel comfortable with the term mediation because it might connote aspect of litigation or might connote that there's a bigger problem than they perceive them there to be or they wish to showcase that there is to other people. And so they use the word facilitation, and that's fine. Essentially, in both cases, you're using a third-party neutral to guide and design the process and really walk you through a way of getting to where you need to go and focusing on that process rather than on the substantive, rather than fully on their relationships, although, of course, relationships come into play anytime you're communicating with anyone about anything. So that's fun. Moving on to slide 26. So what are some reasons for mediating or facilitating or using one of these third-party neutrals? Essentially, you're increasing the likelihood of settlement. You're not dependent on an outside system, but rather you're fully engaged in working through and finding solutions for a problem with another group of individuals. And that means you're more likely to find that settlement, and also you're going to enhance the satisfaction and compliance with that settlement. if you are getting what you need out of a situation, you're not only going to agree to it more quickly and be more satisfied with that agreement, but you're also likely to do it because it meets your needs. So that's a win-win, essentially, is what we're talking about here. It also helps address a wider range of interests because more people are able to communicate more effectively. They're able to bring more resources and more knowledge into the situation. It's like the difference between asking a yes-no question versus asking an open-ended question. If you ask an open-ended question and leave space for people to participate in a more full, open manner, more details, more information, more resources are going to be brought to bear than if you pigeonhole people into a yes-no situation where they can only do X or Y. It enhances the communication and the working relationships between each party. Parties have a tendency, when in this situation, to start to see one another as individuals rather than as representations of the enemy, essentially. It enables the parties to retain control. Because it's a voluntary process, people are still able to walk away at any time that they're not satisfied with how things are going, with how the facilitation is being done, with the negotiation tactics of the other party. I mean, they still have all other resources available to them that they would have had otherwise. And this is just another way of doing it. So parties still have control in this process. Plus, they get to design it and get to decide on the agreement, so all the way through. And with that, are there any questions on slide 27?
Again, on this time, we're going to start to see if anybody on the phone lines has a question. Again, if you've muted your phone line, you'll want to hit #6 to unmute your line, and feel free to identify yourself or organization before asking your question. Okay, and I don't see any in the online queue, but even if we don't address any right now, you guys can continue to type up those comments and questions electronically, and we still have plenty of time to address them as we move forward with the material. So ladies, feel free to continue on past slide 27.
Okay, thanks, Jean. We're on slide 28 now, which we're back to our flow chart here. You've heard from us that we have analyzed the situation with a third-party neutral facilitator, mediator, whatever it is we want to call them. And we've designed a process, and the parties have looked at the process, talked to the mediator, and have now said, yep, let's move ahead. Let's try this thing out. So now we're in the process itself. It might be a series of meetings over a long period of time. It might be one meeting all day, let's gut it out. It might be a series of what we call shuttle diplomacy, where the mediator visits the various parties and builds an agreement without the parties in the same room, either because of problems in where they're all located or problems in whether or not they have the time and the energy all at the same time, or whether they just don't want to sit in the same room. So what are some, going on to slide 29, what are some of the roles of the neutral third party, this facilitator, this mediator, this whatever you want to call them, person, what does that person really do? The main thing that you need to remember about this is that they really are working for all of the parties. They're working for the process. They're representing the process concerns as they go through this. They're not a representative or an advocate of any particular party at the table. They should be acting impartially or neutrally or, you know, not in anybody else's interests. They have worked with people to design the process. They may continue working with either the whole group or a subgroup to set agendas for meetings or for workshops or whatever the process involves. They can assist in writing meeting summaries or summaries of information that come into a website or some other kind of way of communication. They can be the pen who writes down the agreements and brings all the edits to an agreement together. One of the primary reasons in using professional mediators and facilitators is because they have been trained and they may have lots and lots of experience in identifying when parties can and need to move on discuss something else, put something aside, recognize that they're actually all in agreement, although they might be saying it differently. They're also trained in identifying and figuring out ways to overcome impasses. The list goes on page 30, slide 30. The mediator facilitator may also be available to each of the parties separately for consulting or coaching in negotiation strategy, in presentation strategies. This might occur in caucus or personal sessions with a mediator and a party or a group of parties. Sometimes a mediator may see that one party or another at the table could use some assistance thinking their positions through, or some help in understanding how to communicate what they really need or how they really feel in a way that the other parties at the table could hear it and accept it and move on with some solutions for it. So, again, representing the process and not any of the individual parties, a mediator might be able to do some coaching of individual parties so that they can come back and be the best they can be at the table. A mediator may see and be able to articulate the need for more resources or more data. They may see opportunities for closing or making decisions that where people might just keep talking and talking instead of making the decision. They can assist the individual parties in going back to their constituency groups and obtaining ratification of decisions or a settlement, figuring out how to present it and how to discuss the decisions that were made at the table. They can also be brought forward. You can still bring a mediator into the implementation stage of your agreement so that if disputes arise, if misunderstandings about what everybody was supposed to do arise in the future, you can bring the mediator back in to either clarify what was meant at the time the agreement was reached or to help people work through something new that's come up. So on page 31, you see some of what we call the basic tenets for third-party neutrals, what we as mediators or facilitators really believe in our process guidance, in our process advocacy. We really believe and work to ensure that all of the parties are represented at the table or have the opportunity to be represented at the table and that they can behave in ways that are effective in reaching their goals. We refrain from advancing any particular perspective or solution. We're here to advocate the process, not any particular way of solving the substantive issues. Many times an ADR process can include a great deal of confidentiality. There is always confidentiality between the mediator and parties when they meet in a caucus or in private. The mediator is kind of sworn in a very informal, ethical way to keep secrets, whatever secrets a party can designate as confidential, but to use that information in a way in designing the process so that the goals of each of the parties can be recognized and look for resolution. Mediators help the parties put together ground rules and, most importantly, help to enforce those ground rules. When people have agreed that they're not going to trash each other in the press, sometimes the mediator may need to be the one who reminds somebody gently that they had this joint rule if somebody kind of goes off and is quoted in the press in a way that violates that rule. The mediator also helps the parties be very clear about how the decisions will be made. Is it consensus? Is it 51%? Is it 75%? Does it have to include all of everybody or each kind of interest? Working through those issues and making sure that people understand them and revisit them occasionally and do some adaptive management of what they might have decided to begin with regard to decision making. In the end, a mediator needs to be transparent to all of the parties accountable to all the parties and fair to all the parties. Slide 32 is adapted for EPA. It's basically applications where EPA has and can use ADR in the process of the environmental decisions that we make. You'll see that it kind of, the background of the slide is a stream with upstream and downstream, and the decisions indicated by those arrows are upstream on the left-hand side and downstream on the right-hand side with sort of center right a line that indicates when EPA makes a decision with regard to whatever action's being taken or takes an action. Upstream of the decision, EPA can use ADR in negotiations that might involve a permit for pollution, either between EPA or the state and the permittee, or maybe in some cases bringing the community into those negotiations in some way that might influence the issuance of the permit. Developing regulations, we involve the public and have used mediators and facilitators in helping various interest groups and representatives come together to negotiate regulations or to give advisory recommendations with regard to what a regulation might include. We've also used mediators in bringing communities into decisions on cleaning up of hazardous waste sites, Superfund sites, or helping responsible parties or the polluters to reach an agreement with EPA with regard to cleanup provisions. Then we get to the decision. EPA's made a decision. We can still use ADR even after we've made a decision because, as most of you probably know, there's always lawsuits after decisions, or always at least the opportunity for lawsuits under our environmental laws. There are also the opportunity for appeals of permits that have been issued either by EPA or a state. So, and there's always the opportunity to bring a lawsuit against someone who has violated their permit and we're taking enforcement action. So we do use primarily in these cases more on the mediation side than on the facilitation side here, because at this point we're trying to resolve what is generally a more or less legal dispute. So we can bring mediators in to help resolve enforcement actions or allocate liability amongst polluters for cleaning up a site or settling issues in litigation, either litigation against EPA or litigation that EPA has brought against somebody else. Deep breath. Okay. after all of that, thinking about EPA ADR in an environmental justice context, clearly almost all the environmental actions that EPA can or does take might involve an environmental justice context. There's very few decisions we can make, except perhaps internal ones, that don't involve lots of different kinds of people located all over the country. Those kind of cases that are primarily of an environmental justice type focus are primarily those under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits recipients of federal financial assistance from discriminating. The primary actors in a Title VI case are generally a state or a locality who has gotten a federal grant or a federal assistance agreement, money transferred generally under our EPA budget to a state in order to carry out a program. We delegate most of our pollution control programs to states, and the states then implement those programs at the local level. There are cases in which communities or individuals have brought lawsuits against or have identified Title VI actions and based on a state action in which EPA needs to investigate and try to see if we can encourage a settlement between a state and the people bringing the the allegations of discrimination. There are lots of situations that have EJ elements that are not primarily EJ in nature, but may involve those. The primary ones we see at EPA are permits, the granting of permits for releasing pollution, Superfund site cleanup issues. Superfund sites a lot of times are in areas that may have EJ issues. There may be emergency planning cases in which under the emergency planning and community right to know law that EJ communities are more affected because they have less infrastructure and information available to respond to emergencies that EPA might be involved in. We also have our regulations are now subject to environmental justice analysis and have to really take into consideration whether the regulation would affect environmental justice communities in a way that would be different from other communities. So basically, any kind of environmental decision could have an EJ context. We've picked out a couple of cases to bring to your attention. At the end of the presentation, there's a link to at least one case study of this first one on slide 34, the Barrio Logan's community in San Diego. It's a largely Hispanic community in the city of San Diego downtown. It has a mix of businesses and residences that were affected by pollution, greater pollution risks, such things as dry cleaners and plating industry and manufacturers, canners, tanners, bus transportation facilities were all located in this mixed-use area of residential and industrial facilities. The community sought to rectify a lack of organization and direction amongst the various community groups where they had been previously not able to coordinate their interactions and their appeals and requests for funding. EPA assisted, CPRC provided some access to mediators and a local mediator from San Diego and some funding for that mediator to help the community come together, did a situation assessment, proposed a design that would involve various people from the state, EPA, local universities, the community, the business part of the community, the residential part of the community to come together and see if they could jointly coordinate their activities, not agree on one thing to do as a group, but to coordinate their activities so at least they weren't working at counter purposes within the community, enabling them to apply for joint funding opportunities, for instance, coordinating activities to reduce idling of buses near schools, for instance, deal with abandoned and vacant properties and reuse and zoning issues with regard to those properties. At the end of the process, actually the process has continued for many years now, the end of the process, one of the participants said, the facilitator was able to cut through the animosity, the defensiveness, and the reluctance to compromise of the people in the group. Previous enemies, another party said, were working together to figure out what they can do together to fix the problem instead of fighting with each other. So this is a process in which a facilitator was brought on board to help the community to come together and to organize themselves and to talk between each other rather than competing with each other. On slide 35 is another example in New Orleans. This was pre-Katrina, but the city of New Orleans at the time had not taken an inventory of all the brownfields or former industrial potentially contaminated sites in the downtown historic and residential area. in order to really look at this, we provided, EPA provided some funding assistance to bring a facilitator on board, a local facilitator again, who could do a good situation assessment and come up with a process design that would help the community not only identify the sites of the brownfields in this area, but also talk together about what kind of redevelopment would be appropriate in those communities for those brownfield sites. The facilitator recommended putting a formal consortium together. The consortium was unique in that it had about 36, 38 members, half of whom were community members who were selected and elected from the different neighborhood associations. It was designed such that the community had a majority on this consortium so that the communities would be rep to the extent they could work together now, could basically be in control, although the decisions were made by consensus rather than voting, but they weren't going to be outnumbered by the 9 representatives from the economic development world and the 8 representatives of technical experts. What they were able to accomplish when working together was to inventory the brownfield site, to work with New Orleans and the state of Louisiana to establish some regulations with regard to how voluntary cleanup and redevelopment of these sites might proceed, so that there wasn't a lot of litigation that would stop the redevelopment. They managed to clean up a number of sites of previous cannery facilities and restore them not just into economic drivers, but also into parks and other joint use sites around the city. So we have another opportunity here for questions.
We do have one question that's in the online queue, but again, I'm just going to check to see if anybody on the telephone lines has a question. Remember, if you're on the phone, you'll need to hit #6 to unmute your line. Okay, since I don't hear any questions on the phone, I'm going to go ahead and read this question that comes in from Arlington, Virginia. And they ask, how many ADRs do you process in a year? It's actually a two-part question, so I'll let you answer the first before I get to the second part.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Generally, this center has our some involvement in about 100 cases, active cases a year. This isn't 100 new ones walking in the door a year, but at any one time, there might be about 100 that have gone on during the year, either starting or continuing or finishing up. We don't fund, our center doesn't fund that many in a year. EPA does fund many of the facilitators that are, or mediators that are used in these cases, but occasionally funding may come from Department of Justice, for instance, if it's ADR in a litigation context, or it may be joint funding of the parties and EPA and a state into that project.
Okay.
The other part of the question, as we can see it, is how long can an ADR process go on?
Yep.
We're very liberal about what we call an ADR process. ADR is, in our view, is the use of a facilitator or a mediator to help parties overcome or work together, overcome differences or work together. So sometimes an ADR process may be providing a facilitator for a single public meeting for 4 hours on next Thursday. Sometimes it may be providing a facilitator or a mediator to negotiation of a rule. I'm thinking of one several years ago on the total coliform rule, which was a national rule that discussed the sampling regimen for testing drinking water for coliform bacteria. That one went on for nearly 2 years, I guess, and probably had 18 or 25 meetings over that two-year period. So it varies quite a bit because our definition is so all-encompassing.
Okay, and again, one last check to see if anybody on the phone lines has a question before we carry on. Okay, ladies, feel free to continue on with the presentation. I think we're moving from slide number 36 on to slide 37.
All right, so on slide 37, I'll start to talk about the outcomes of the ADR process. On slide 38, there are many potential outcomes for an ADR process. It, like I said before, it's very flexible, it's very participant-driven, so really what your outcome is what you want it to be. Parties can improve the capacity to manage and resolve conflict within themselves. Typically, all parties are satisfied with the process because it is what you want. You are creating what outcome you want out of this process, and so you are able to determine when you think that your conflict is resolved or when you think you can manage it amongst yourselves. Issues that parties can agree on are addressed with other approaches. Parties reach complete and durable agreements. Again, the parties want to maintain the agreements because it's something that they're happy with. It's something that they've negotiated through, and they really think it's possible. It's very rare in ADR to come to a settlement that's not possible to implement. So agreements are almost always implemented because the parties know what they're capable of. That can't always be said with litigation. If you go in front of a judge, the judge may have no subject matter expertise in environmental resolutions. They might have an agreement that can't be implemented, or if it can be implemented, you have to go through a massive amount of work just to even figure out how to do that. And so typically all parties are satisfied with what they've achieved because they're happy, it's implementable, and they know how to work with each other now. Moving on to slide 39, the next steps after an agreement is reached is that, as Deb mentioned, you have to, oftentimes if you're representing a constituency group, if you're an environmentalist representing a conservation group, you have to go back to your constituents and have them ratify the agreement. You sign the agreements, and then you start to develop those next steps. How do you implement this agreement? Who's going to be responsible for what? What's the time frame for implementation and for completing some of the tasks in your agreement? You also want to start to plan for contingencies. What if your plan fails? What do you do then? What if an agreement is breached? What if one of the parties doesn't follow through on what they're supposed to do and they are in breach of your agreement? What do you do then? Do you come back to mediation or do you go further elsewhere? On to slide 40. So this leads into the next part of our topic, which is monitoring outcomes. As Deb alluded to, our ADR processes, any ADR processes really, can go on as long as you need them to go on. So say with mediation, you can go through a mediation and solve your immediate issues, but you might, oh, it's on slide 41, my apologies. Say if you go in mediation, you might have some pressing issues that you need to resolve immediately, and you resolve those issues. However, you might have further issues that come up later and might require you to circle back and to come back into mediation and come back and work through those issues that crop up. So you want to start to monitor those outcomes, ensure the proper implementation of agreements, circle back to rework elements. If you find out it's not working, you can always come back and work through it again. You can follow through with planned consequences if the agreement is not implemented. One of the most fantastic things about ADR is it doesn't preclude you from using one of the other processes on that continuum of conflict resolution. So say you are working with a company trying to implement a permit system in an environmental justice community and it doesn't work, the mediation doesn't follow through, you're not able to reach an agreement, you can still litigate. That option is still available to you. You have the availability to use any of those options on the continuum if one of the processes doesn't work for you. It's extremely flexible that you can just move on and try something different.
Okay, on to slide 42, looking specifically a little bit deeper into some of the benefits and issues around the environmental justice concerns. Slide 43. Just for a refresher, in case you're not aware, EPA defines environmental justice as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. I want to highlight for you the term meaningful involvement, and keep that in mind as we go through the next couple of slides looking at some of the ADR implications. Slide 44. So we've talked about the general benefits for ADR, but there are some unique benefits that are particular to environmental justice communities, essentially the individuals that EPA is trying to ensure have meaningful involvement in all of these different elements of environmental life. ADR processes can bring in a wider range of interests. We mentioned that before. This means in an environmental justice context, a community can bring to light the fact that their culture, their heritage, their local needs and concerns and values may be different from the broader range of American perspectives that maybe EPA is making and basing decisions off of. So, for example, we've had situations where EPA uses a set number of essentially grams of fish that an average person would consume a day. So when they're telling you whether or not it's safe to eat fish, they're basing it on this kind of assumption as to how much fish one might eat. That said, there are a lot of communities in the country that live off of fish or eat more fish than the average. That might be subsistence farm fishers or people who have a kind of cultural norm of eating more fish. Now, that means if, you know, they kind of set a standard and say, well, it's fine for people eating this small amount of fish per day, right, or per week, or whatever the regulation mandates. But an individual is eating 10 times that, and they think they're fine because EPA says they're fine. They're not really fine because they're eating vastly more. So being able to pull in that information so that EPA is aware of those issues, aware of those concerns, and is able to cater and change the regulations in certain circumstances or make people aware of the amount that they're using as their baseline, they can make better decisions that are going to be more helpful and beneficial to that community. And that's part of that meaningful involvement, really bringing them into the aspects of decision-making so that our assumptions are more accurate to the life of all Americans. That is also true for values and belief structures and how people go about using the natural environment around them, because all of those impact how our individual health is being impacted by that environment. It also creates a space for the disenfranchised to be heard. As we talked about, the mediator facilitator, one of their main goals as a mediator process guide is to ensure that all parties have their voices heard in that discussion. In environmental justice communities, there may be a history of certain groups not feeling like they have a voice, not being heard, being ignored or marginalized, and this is a process that brings them to the table and gives them a space to be heard in a full way. Communities that are driven by activism or have been achieving certain goals through protest, through media, through litigation, they continue to have that control and the ability to go through those means, as Aileen mentioned. So this is a situation where they can come to the table without giving up any of their options to meet their needs through any means necessary. But it is a more effective way in some cases for getting what they really need and moving forward rather than being embroiled in an antagonistic relationship. And as we keep saying again and again, everyone walks away with something they can live with. And that includes more justice for that community in an environmental context. Going on to slide 45, there's often a lot of mistrust, to be honest, of government, but also of corporations in environmental justice communities. Sometimes there's a lot of mistrust of each other in communities because, as we all know, communities can be very diverse with a wide variety of interests and a wide variety of positions. So any kind of contentious situation, there's an element of mistrust, but especially in situations where there may be long histories of abuse, there may be long histories of being ignored or feeling ignored in the process. And this is one of the ways to build that trust back, to open a dialogue, to create an element and a space for respectful communication, and to bring things forward so individuals see each other as individuals working towards a common goal rather than adversaries. And so it does help to build that trust and really help overcome some of the histories of injustice or mistrust or stigma that has occurred around a land or a community. There are also ways to bring that history and that cultural elements that may be engaged in the situation into a process. So if, for example, it is known that a large portion of the participants in a process are very, very upset about a specific element that happened, and they don't feel like they've ever been heard on that topic, that nobody recognizes or acknowledges that that thing happened, there might be a way to build that into the process so that they can express what they need to express to be able to work on other issues. And all of that would come forward in a situation assessment. See, all of this builds on itself. So a thing to note here is that this is a really a different way of interacting. It's essentially the difference between being a revolutionary and being a bureaucrat in the government. If you've been fighting and struggling and pushing to be noticed, to be heard, to demand the justice that you deserve, it's often hard to shift gears and start working with people that you saw as enemies. If you're able to do so, and a mediator or facilitator can help you do so through a convening process, it can be extremely rewarding, and you may be able to get more out of it than you would through other means. But as I said, if not, you can always go do those other means. So for ADR, going on to slide 46, ADR should help balance power differentials. There isn't a bias in a process for somebody who has a fancy title, somebody who has more money, somebody who in our general society would be seen as having more power. In that way, it's a great equalizer, and individuals all have the same power. Money does not create more voice in this situation. And in that way, it helps empower parties. So all stakeholders can work together to find viable solutions for them. They can leverage what resources they have in a broader context. So now it's not just me as a community member trying to think what I can do or what my community can do, but now it's me with the state representation, with government, federal government representation, with perhaps industries that are aligned. If those are the stakeholders involved in the group, now we're all thinking together, how do we all bring our resources to bear? And all of a sudden, the pie is much bigger, and we can achieve a lot more if we're willing and able to work through a process. And the facilitator will help guide that, so we're more likely to succeed than to derail ourselves with fighting, which is very tempting to do in some situations. Moving on to slide 47. So as I mentioned, ADR can be used with corporations. Corporations are not necessarily, although they could be, they're not necessarily evil. So an ADR process can help them feel more secure in engaging in a structured way with the community and gives them guidance on how to interact. Likewise, it can help a community feel safe that they're not going to be manipulated or they're not going to be pushed around by an industry that may have more money or power or resources in general. So it can be a really good tool in working in a situation where the two parties are an environmental justice community and an industry. It can also be used with the federal government, state government, tribal government, city government, any government, to work through some complications there. At least on the federal level, we have a lot of rules and regulations that we have to abide by, and they're not necessarily easy to understand. So working with a facilitator can help us as bureaucrats figure out how to communicate that, can help communities express what their concerns are in a way that we can hear it, and really bridge that divide and create a structure and organization so that we can plug into something rather than having to create something new and spend a lot of staff resources doing that kind of building. It can also be used just amongst communities. Communities in and amongst themselves have a lot of differences, have a lot of different interests. They may not all agree on issues or concerns or values. And regardless of if the dispute is with EPA or with an industry or with any outside party, even if the dispute or a situation is happening within the community itself, a facilitator or mediator could still be very useful to help guide and help people work through those issues to reach the solutions that they need.
Okay, we're almost done. You can move on to slide 49, which is our center's very favorite cartoon. From Hagar the Horrible, you see a group of warriors coming to get, I don't know, is that the king? Anyway, he's about to be pushed right off the edge here. And he says, I suppose it's too late to request a mediator. It's probably never too late. you can think of the mediator as being someone who can come in and kind of, you know, act as like the umpire and, you know, halt the parties and say, okay, stop, let's just take a break here and talk. Put down your weapons. don't put them in my face. But to be able to keep people from falling off the edge, to keep people from doing things that might permanently harm the ability to solve a problem. On page 50, just our quick recap, ADR is a way to resolve conflicts that can increase the empowerment of community. Communities in discussions about environmental issues create results that are driven by the participants, and to transform relationships into workable, ongoing, and successful partnerships, as illustrated by the two cases that we brought to you. ADR and environmental justice can work together well because it results in a solution created by the community, for the community, with the cooperation of everybody who is necessary to actually implement that solution so that it can actually happen and just isn't an empty promise. So on pages 51 and 52, we've given you a number of links on page 51 to websites where there's more information with regard to environmental justice, public participation, alternative dispute resolution, consensus building, collaborative problem solving. The last of the dot points on page 51 actually gives you a link to a document that includes a long evaluation study of the Barrio Logan site in San Diego, if you're interested to read more about that.
As well as five other case studies of collaboration in environmental justice communities.
Yep. On page 52, there's a number of useful references. These are kind of our primary reference sources for our profession. A practical guide to consensus is a relatively short guide from the Policy Consensus Initiative in Oregon. Mediation process is kind of the key document book that we all use to learn how to be a mediator and remind ourselves what mediators do. Consensus Building Handbook is a really fat book out of the Harvard Negotiation Project that talks about all of the steps involved in putting together a consensus process. There are a couple of other guides here that are more specific to communities. Community Guide to Using ADR to Secure Environmental Justice from the Environmental Law Institute, and the collaboration, A Guide for Environmental Advocates, which we've given you the link for, are very good analyses. Also, the Red Lodge Clearinghouse out of Montana has put together a handbook on entering into collaboration that's very useful. And then two final papers that talk about managing scientific and technical information and building trust in environmental issues are good papers to read from the Policy Consensus Group. So at last, we're at the end, we're done, and we'd love to engage any questions that you have or any examples or challenges. This could be Stump the Chump if you'd like. Just call us up or send us a note over the electronic system. Tell us what you're thinking.
Okay. Again, if you're on the telephone lines, remember you'll need to unmute if you've done that. So you can either use your own unmute button or simply hit, pardon me, #6 to unmute your line. Feel free to identify yourself and organization and ask your question or make a comment. And again, those of you who are streaming the audio online, you're welcome to type up an electronic comment or question. If you haven't done so already, I don't see any in the queue now, but I'll wait just a few more seconds to see if anybody's got something coming in on the line before we move towards the closeout. And while we're waiting to see if we have any electronic questions come in, do you, this is Jean, I'm just going to ask a general question. Do you do training on ADR other than this event? Is there, are there other training opportunities if people want to learn more about the process?
Our unit does do trainings for EPA employees, both in headquarters and in the regional offices. Very often they invite their state counterparts to these trainings that we do. Do negotiation trainings. We've done some ADR seminars and workshops. We also go to some of the main EPA conferences for Superfund and Brownfields and other conferences and offer training and workshops in these. There are training in ADR in a lot of communities. There are a lot of community-based mediation organizations that you can look to in your own community. In D.C. here, for instance, they have something called the Multi-Door Courthouse, which trains mediators for small claims and divorce and civil litigation. Better Business Bureau sometimes trains mediators. A number of universities around the country have clinics for their business or public administration or law students, and sometimes those clinics do some community-based training. And you guys have any other ideas?
Yeah, there are universities all over the country that are starting. ADR is a growing field. It's relatively new. The ADR Act, I believe, is in 1996. And so ADR is one of the newer mechanisms by which the in conflict resolution. And so it's a growing field. There are a lot more trainings that are being put out there. There are a lot of organizations like the U.S. Institute for Environmental Conflict Resolution. If you search like IECR on Google, it's one of the big foundations that helps train for ADR. Just even speaking of schools, Harvard has a big one. GW and Georgetown in the D.C. area are both, they both have ADR classes and master's programs. The University of Oregon out on the West Coast and the University of Washington have ADR programs. There are bases also in, say, Tucson, Missouri, and Denver. So honestly, if you look where you're based, the chances are that there's going to be a local community program or university that'll be able to help train you. It's also a requirement for all district courts in the federal circuit system to have some sort of ADR mechanism. And so anywhere that you go, the federal court in your area is going to be required to have some sort of ADR process. So say if you're not necessarily interested in doing ADR in the environmental field, the courts will have a mechanism for ADR that you can observe and see if you like it.
Well, Well, Jean, okay, great. Do you have any more questions for us?
Yeah, I don't see any other electronic questions coming into the queue. So in the interest of time, I'll go ahead and ask if you guys have any final closing statements or comments that you'd like to make before I walk through the closing procedures for today.
Just that if anybody does have any follow-up questions or thoughts or would just like to chat about stuff, our contact information is available there in the materials, and you can contact us, and we're here to help.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. With that, I'm going to ask everybody to move on to slide number 54, which is the second to last slide, and it's our resources and feedback form. I just wanted to point everybody to two important resources. These links are available on the seminar homepage as well. So if you just have a printout in front of you, you can actually refer back to the homepage for today's event to get to these links. They'll be active from this point forward on into the future. So that first link is a link to the resources page for this event, which has not only a copy of the presentation materials to download, but also links to other related sites, for example, like the Office of Environmental Justice's website. The second link on slide 54 is a link to our short feedback form. It does take just a minute or so to fill it out, and I do read each and every one of the responses that gets processed through that feedback system. So I would encourage you to take just a minute to submit your thoughts and comments on today's session, because it will help us as well as our organizers and presenters to continually improve and offer free training like this through Clueen. If you participated from one location with multiple attendees sitting with you, each individual person can fill out their own feedback form, even though you participated under one registration line. When one person fills out the form, there'll be a link that will appear to let someone else hop on and fill out their own feedback form link. So you can certainly each take your turn. If you're looking to get confirmation of your participation today for training records, we don't issue CEUs or PDHs, but when you fill out the feedback form, you can check a box to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records, which will at least verify that you did submit feedback at the conclusion of today's seminar. Again, if you're not at a computer with internet access, you can certainly come back and fill out that feedback form later on. And you may find that if you have a copy of the materials or presentation slides, as well as your confirmation email or registration email, that's enough to verify your participation with your accrediting organization. With that, I'm going to bring everybody on to slide number 55, which is just a bit of an advertisement for us on Clueen. We're continuing to try to reach out to our audience and share information in the best way and to stay connected with our target audience. And so we've recently launched Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn services. So if you wanted to get immediate updates as soon as new training opportunities like this are available or learn about new archive seminars once we posted them, I would encourage you to either follow us or like us on Facebook. Again, follow us on Twitter, or feel free to join the LinkedIn group. I also want to extend my thanks to our presenters, again, who came to us from the EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. Again, I think you guys gave a great talk today, and I appreciate your time in preparing and delivering today's presentation. I also want to thank our organizers in the Office of Environmental Justice, or OEJ, for helping to set up today's seminar series. And just to remind everyone, this is just one in a whole series that's going on throughout the summer. So there will be future deliveries of the OEJ-sponsored events throughout the summer. And if you're interested in learning more about that series, I would encourage you to contact the Office of Environmental Justice. So this represents the formal conclusion for today's Clueen Internet Seminar. My thanks go out to everyone who joined us today. I hope that you found it to be a useful expenditure of your time. Thank you very much, and have a great day.